we made it to a Thursday here on Main Street on Prairie Public, and we are very glad that you've joined us today. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in the second half of today's show, News Director Dave Thompson and I will review the news of North Dakota and the region, and our movie reviewer extraordinaire, Matt Olean, stops by the Main Street studio. This week's movie review is about the life of Chuck. There's our music that pops up once a month here on Main Street. It's time for Philosophical Currents with our great friend, Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein, a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor in the Department of Philosophy and Religion at the University of North Dakota. And Jack is also the director of the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life and the host of the public radio show, Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. Jack, welcome back to Main Street.
Thanks for having me. This is one of the highlights of my month, so I really appreciate it.
And I think our listeners really appreciate your presence as well, and I know that I do. This is a hard topic. We contemplated talking about something mundane like university studies and some other things like that. Instead, we've settled on war, and the theme that we're going to center our discussion around is it possible to talk about war and treat people like human beings at the same time? And Jack, you have an Iranian friend that you've been checking on regularly. Of course, it's a very fluid situation with what's happening in Iran. And I wonder, is it possible to talk about war and still treat everyone involved, soldiers, civilians, our enemies, as human beings first?
This is actually an interesting story that I don't really understand how it happened. But many years ago, I got contacted by a couple different Iranian scholars who wanted to translate some of my books into Persian. And over the years, we became friends. And there's one in particular who I'm very close to and who has a virtual relationship with my daughter. And when the bombs started dropping in Tehran, I checked with him regularly, but also the internet was in and out. And so sometimes he would disappear and sometimes he wouldn't. And I'm torn, of course, because on the one hand, I want global peace. I want global safety. I don't want a rogue state to have nuclear arms. But at the same time, I know these people. And if something happened to people that I care about, I would be devastated. And every human being has people like that. Every human being is connected to somebody, and every loss, however anonymous the person might be, is a tragedy. And so we have this real philosophical problem. And I think that the way I want to emphasize it to a listener is I got some numbers. And think about as a base number the fact that the estimate of what's happening in Gaza is that 50,000 Gazans roughly have been killed. And this has been a number that has been trotted out by many people as to how horrible the war is, which is perfectly understandable. 50,000 is roughly the same number of traffic deaths in the United States. 42,000 people died in traffic-related deaths in 2022 in the United States. 46,000 people died in gun-related deaths in the United States, roughly the same amount. And then we look at war. In the Syrian civil war, 600,000 people were killed. Currently in the Ukrainian-Russian war, we don't know the numbers, but between 170,000 to 1 million people were killed. In the Congo, in the 10-year conflict, 5.4 million people were killed, and that started up again. And then in World War II, the deaths were about 75 million, so 50 to 55 million civilians, and 21 to 25 military deaths, and 5 million people, there were 5 million prisoners of war. So you look at those numbers and you think, well, 50,000 in Gaza, that's nothing, right? That's a drop in the bucket. Why should we care when the numbers are so large? But then we have the flip side. And the flip side is that's 50,000 real human beings. That's 50,000 lives. That's 50,000 possibilities. That's children. That's innocent people. That's elderly. That's teachers. That's people who are donating blood. That's, you know, farmers. That's everybody. And so the philosophical quandary that we face is how do we balance the abstractness of war numbers with the reality that every one of those people is a real person and that they matter. And that's a very, very hard.
How do you talk about, or what do you think about the moral cost of all of this, Jack? Some people believe it's all justified. Some people believe none of it's justified. Some people believe it's necessary. Some believe none of this is necessary. How do you think about what the cost of what you just described is?
So there's two separate questions that are implicit in what you're asking. The first is often called just war theory. And the idea is, what makes a war just? What makes a war right? What makes a war moral? This has been debated for thousands of years. And one of the standard ways of summarizing it is that a just war is a war of defense. That being the antagonist in the war, being the invader, being the cause of the war is never justified, and defending yourself is almost always justified. And then there are subordinate questions about what kind of weapons we use and whether gas attacks can be justified as opposed to munitions and things like that. So what makes a war justified is one set of questions. But the second thing you're asking, which is much harder, is how do you measure the cost of war? We can reduce it to money. We can reduce it to the fact that a B-2 bomber is more expensive than 10 years of funding public radio, right? That
more than 10, I'm sure.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. You know, that for the cost of the munitions that we dropped on Iran, we could fund Medicaid, we could fund education, we could do all of these things. So there's monetary opportunity cost. The problem with that approach is that, once again, it abstracts from the cost of the human experience. How do you measure the loss a child has when they lose their parents, when they see their parents dying, when they're with their parents as they suffer? We can ask about the psychological cost. We can also ask about the long-term political cost, because every time a child sees their parents bombed by another country, that's a new potential terrorist. That's another person who is going to continue the fight, exacerbate things. And then, of course, there's the lost cost of creativity, the lost cost of discovery, the lost cost of wisdom. Every time we kill someone, a possible universe disappears. Every time we destroy a people, the possibility of greatness is wiped out. And so the real costs of war are things that we can't quantify. They're things that are very, very hard to compare. Because on the one hand, right, Jack Weinstein's life is a lot like Craig Blumenschein's life, right? I'm one person. If I died, that would be terrible. You're one person. If you died, that would be terrible. But on another side of it, there's no comparison between Jack Weinstein's life and Craig Blumenschein's life, because we are unique individuals. There is nothing, I'm not reducible to you. I'm not substitutable to you. I have kids, you have kids, they're not substitutable or interchangeable either. So when we talk about the costs of war, we have to decide, are we having a quantitative conversation about money, about comparison, or are we having a much more meaningful, abstract, qualitative conversation about the experiences and the tragedies that war asks, because we only think about it on a large scale?
That violence that war is it ever ethical? And how can it be done without dehumanizing the other side? Because I think if we think about it in terms like you just discussed, I'm not sure we would have the wars that we have or that we've had in the past. And perhaps I'm very wrong there, but there's that tension there that if we reduce it to non-human things, that it makes it more tolerable. Can violence ever be ethically executed?
The tolerability is a huge factor. And one of the things we know from history is that one of the great influences in the Vietnam War was the fact that it was the first war that was televised. That up until that point, people would hear about wars in the newspapers or through storytelling or what have you. Even with photographs during World War II, there's something distant about the photographs. When Americans saw for the first time the violence of Vietnam War in their living room, when it was very common in the late 60s and early 70s for the families to sit in their living room and watch the nightly news together. There were, remember, our listeners should remember, there were only three networks really at that point, and everyone was watching basically the same thing. And they would see the horrible destruction and the suffering of the war, and that would change things because they were able to see it from the soldier's experience, from the victim's experience. And then at the end of the nightly news, they would often scroll the names of all the soldiers that died that day. And so what you're introducing is the role of empathy and the role of the imagination. And these two factors are the greatest inhibitor of deciding whether or not to sue for peace, of trying to find the other way around it. Because if you have no empathy, if you do not engage your imagination, then you don't have to think about the victims. You don't have to think about the soldiers. You don't have to think about the civilians. You don't have to think about the destruction of great architecture or the wildlife that's being destroyed. You don't have to think about the impact on the climate and all of that sort of stuff. This is exacerbated by the fact that in the modern world anyway, the people who declare and run the war are not the people who fight the war. The president isn't going to go on the battlefield. The generals, as a general rule, don't go on the battlefield. And it's usually not their kids who fight either. And so the personal cost of the people who decide the war is much less than the everyday person. And when it's not your kids, when it's not your neighbor's kids, when it's not your loss, it's easier to turn off that empathy. It's easier to turn off that imagination. These are the things that we're facing when we're trying to have these discussions. And so when you ask whether violence can ever be justified, part of what you're asking is, do we answer that question strategically? Do we answer that question abstractly in, you know, following some moral theory, or do we ask that question in a way that asks, is it ever justified to take Sally's arm, to make Muhammad a quadriplegic, to ask a mother to lose her three sons? Those are very, very different questions.
We're in the middle of our philosophical currents discussion with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. I normally, Jack, say we're enjoying our conversation with you, but I'm not saying that today, but it's an important conversation. Jack's the Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor in the Department of Philosophy and Religion at the University of North Dakota, who joins us every month for these challenging discussions. Today's topic is it possible to talk about war and treat people like human beings at the same time, and about how we balance the necessity for violence with the recognition of horrors are harming others. Jack, you've written a lot and we've talked a lot about moral responsibility. So in a time of war, where does that responsibility lie? Is it on us? Is it on our governments? Is it on our society? I'm not sure what that means. Where does the moral responsibility about war lie during a time of war?
So let's take the example of North Korea for a second. I don't think very many people would argue that the average North Korean would be responsible for a war, because it's not a democracy. It's an authoritarian dictatorship. And no one has the power to counter the leader's decisions. Yet, at the same time, if you are a North Korean on a battlefield and you have a gun in your hand, nothing is stopping you from saying, "I will not kill," and putting your weapon down and saying, "I would rather die than kill." So even in the most extreme circumstances, even in the most authoritarian circumstances, we have this tension between lack of political power and the individual agency that any person has to say, "I will not kill under any circumstances." Now, maybe that's too much to ask. Maybe when faced with the problem of kill or be killed, we're going to reduce ourselves to the most sort of animalistic self-defense. But that's a moral conclusion, that it's always okay to defend yourself. move the conversation over to a democracy, to a society in where people really have power to unseat the president, to influence the structure, then all of a sudden we have a different level of civic responsibility. Because if you disapprove of the war and you haven't bothered even to call your Congress member, if you disapprove of the war and you haven't sent an email or made your position known, then the case can be made you are not acting morally responsible. And of course, the flip side is that if you do support the war and if you do think that this is a moral and necessary act, you need to participate as well. Same conversation about voting, about thinking in terms of your political responsibilities. But again, from the 1960s on, there was a slogan amongst the peace activists that you would see often in bumper stickers later on when bumper stickers became a thing, which was, what if we threw a war and nobody came, right? Again, during Vietnam, before everything was computerized in the same way, one of the great acts of protest was for young people to get their draft card, which was the computer record of their existence, and burn their draft card. Because if they burnt their draft card, they couldn't be drafted and they wouldn't be sent to the front. If you were found out, it was a crime and you could be sent to prison. But the people who were burning those draft cards were saying, I would rather go to prison than fight in this war. I would rather go to jail. I would rather personally be punished and kill somebody, especially kill an innocent person. Famously, it was Malcolm X, but I can't remember the source of the exact quote, but civil rights activists were very famously would argue that they were treated so poorly, Black people were treated so poorly in the United States, that there was no justification to go to war. And why would, and I'm thinking of a very specific quote that I'm going to butcher, but it's something like, why would the Black man go kill the yellow man in a country that has nothing to do with them for the white man, right? Now, the language is a little old-fashioned, et cetera, et cetera. But that too is one of the great questions, which is, how are people used and manipulated and exploited to engage in these wars? So you always have this tension, and I'm saying that a lot, this word tension, because it's so complicated. You always have this tension between the political authority and the political power you have to influence war and the fighting of war, and the individual agency that a person always has to just refuse, to take the punishment for refusing, but to say, I will never kill another person. I mean, just to take it more explicitly, someone comes up to you with a gun and says, shoot your children or I will shoot you. Craig, what do you do?
Shoot me.
Yeah, right. I mean, there's no question, right? I would rather die than kill my child. You would rather die than kill your children. And all over the world, throughout history, we have parents who have jumped on their kids to shield them from bullets, to shield them from bombs, to who have given up their own life without a moment's hesitation to sacrifice their own children. So why, and here is the great philosophical question at the core of all this, is why are my children more important than your children? Why should I protect my kid and not protect your kid? And there are lots of answers for that, but that's a hard question. Because my kid is more important to me than your kids, but your kids are more important to you than my kids. And some stranger in some foreign lands, kids barely register on the scale for us because they're not real. But my kid is just as important as your kid. And your kid is just as important as the kids in Israel, the kids in Congo, the kids in Gaza, the kids in Syria, the kids wherever. Right? Whatever your position on the issues are. Why is one kid more important than the other? Why am I willing to lay down my life for my kid and not other people's kids? That's a hard, hard question.
So hard. I've considered protests that we've all seen, Jack, relative to the fate of Palestinians. what's happened in Gaza. You referenced the statistic, 50,000 deaths, I think you said. But we remember what happened on October 7th, 2023, when groups like Hamas and other Palestinian groups launched attacks against folks in Israel who were innocent. So the question then becomes, can you support one side of a war while still recognizing the full human suffering that you so graphically talked about that's happening maybe on both sides, but certainly on the other side of the war? If you feel strongly that Israel has every bit of its right, and I'm not arguing that they do or they don't, but sure, if you feel strongly that they have every right to do everything that they've done in Gaza, can you support that, but still recognize the humanity and suffering that's happened on the other side without being considered wishy-washy, less patriotic?
So you can. And there's lots of different ways of managing this, including insisting that your politicians, that your, I'll speak in abstract terms, that your country distinguish between combatants and non-combatants, right? That it might be morally okay to kill a soldier, but it's never okay to kill a concert goer in rural Israel. You don't torture, you don't use rape as a weapon of war, you don't keep trophies, right? There are lots of ways that are strategic, that are the rules of war, the Geneva Convention for War Prisoners, and things like that. And again, one of the complexities with the Vietnam War was that in guerrilla wars, it's much harder to determine who's a combatant and who's not. The American soldiers would burn down entire villages because they couldn't tell, because sometimes little kids and sometimes women were combatants because it's a guerrilla war. And that's the same complexity with fighting in Gaza, is you have children soldiers and you have a population that hides the Hamas soldiers in ways that are different than Israel. But I want to put that aside. But then there's a whole other way of acknowledging it. And I'll summarize it in this way. Don't be glib and don't celebrate the violence, right? One of the worst things I think we can do, it seems minor in the context because we're talking about real violence and real suffering, real loss. But one of the worst things I think we can do is go on social networks or talk to our friends and say, ha ha, we killed 1,000 of them. Ha ha, they're losing. You know, they all deserve it. This language that dehumanizes people. There's a very famous recording of a Hamas soldier on the phone on October 7th. And I can't remember the exact number, so I'm going to say 12, but I'm making that number up. It might have been 7. I can't remember. And he's talking to his mother and he's saying, "Mom, I did it. I killed 12 Jews, right? 12 Jews died because of me." And there's something so unbearably horrible about someone taking such pleasure and pride in killing other people, in reducing all of the victims to this, you know, this term Jew, right, which is a dehumanization tactic in and of itself, and which is a way of sort of declaring your manhood. Right. There's a longstanding tradition of suggesting that boys only become men in war. And that's a horrible, horrible tradition, because I think boys become men, to limit this to that phrase, boys become men when they love, when they protect, when they care, when they provide, when they do all of these things. And so one of the really important ways in which we acknowledge the humanity of other people is the way we choose to talk about war and the way that we suffer with the victims, even if we're not on the victim's side.
We can do so without seeming naive or unpatriotic.
That's right. I'll state right outright that I think that the Ukrainians are on the just side of that current war. And I think Ukraine deserves its independence. And I think that the invasion of Ukraine was completely unjust and immoral. But up to 1 million Russians have been killed in the war. Up to 1 million Russians have been forcibly drafted, pushed to fight, victims of propaganda. That is so unbearable to think about. That is so awful. And so to recognize that even as they may victimize the Ukrainians, the Russians who participate in the war are themselves victims, are themselves manipulated, may in fact be very good people in their day-to-day life experience. To be able to leave space to acknowledge that, to be able to look past the propaganda, to be able to, for lack of a better phrase, think about war and cry. These are the prerequisites for recognizing the humanity of other people. The moment we stop recognizing that war is a tragedy, that war is a nightmare, that war is among, if not the worst things human beings do, the moment we glory in war and celebrate war and take pride in the victimization of war, have crossed the line. There's nothing wrong with celebrating the end of a war victories, recognizing D-Day, for example. There's nothing wrong with being relieved that your side won and being thrilled and grateful that your child made it home alive. There's nothing wrong with that. But we have to balance that, temper that, counter that with the perpetual recognition of the loss, of the suffering of other people, and not glibly, jingoistic, two-dimensionally celebrate the destruction of other individuals and another culture and another civilization.
Jack, there's even more to talk about, but we'll end it here. I hope your Iranian friend is okay.
Thank you.
Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein has been my guest. It's a monthly segment we call Philosophical Currents. Jack's a philosophy professor at the University of North Dakota, and he takes time to visit with us about tough topics often, and certainly this was one of them each and every month, and we are grateful. Jack, thank you.
Thank you. It's always an honor to talk to you and to address the listeners.
Still ahead on Main Street, news director Dave Thompson and I review the news, and Matt Olean reviews the movie The Life of Chuck. Stay with us.
Extra, extra, read all about it. Gather round, everybody.
And with that music, we welcome Dave Thompson back to the Main Street studio. A kind of messy Main Street studio, Dave, as you're aware, and as we're letting our listeners know today, we'll be gone for the next week after today until, I think, July 8th. But, of course, you are with us when we're here, Dave, to review the news. So
Absolutely.
Welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you, Craig. Good to be here.
Dave, power is finally back on, essentially, for everyone after thousands went without electricity after the big storm on Friday night. What's the latest?
Well, basically what you're seeing now is the cleanup phase, and Governor toured several of the towns that were hit hard by the strong winds, the heavy rain, the hail, and the tornadoes that spun up. There was an interesting discussion at the Industrial Commission today that one of the things that they don't want to let go out of the public consciousness is, you know, crops are fine when you and they seem to be okay right now. However, they have to be stored somewhere, and the storage buildings are gone. A lot of them are gone now, so a real challenge for the farmers is where you're going to find storage for these crops, for corn, for soybeans, things like that. So there's a plan being hatched to see if there's some kind of bridge loan they can have through the Bank of North Dakota to help these farmers rebuild their storage facilities, and then when their insurance companies come through, then they can pay the banker back.
Dave, what's the governor's role in declaring a disaster area, and what does that really mean for the state?
Well, there are a couple things. Number one, he declares a disaster because that starts the state resources, you know, state disaster recovery resources, and the Bank of North Dakota, of course, is one of them financially. Plus, it also allows them to apply for a federal grant, so they asked for a federal government declaration of disaster. And the governor has said he's been in contact with USDA, and USDA is very much behind it. So they're expecting that the president's going to have a presidential disaster declaration soon.
We were in Jamestown yesterday and saw a lot of the remnants of the storm from Friday night. They had water restrictions. They had potential sewer issues.
Yeah, but again, with sewer and with water, you do need electric power. And Otter Tail was working overtime to get customers up and running again and had some help from some of the local co-ops to get the lines back up. So I know there was some concern there, and of course, there was some debris in some of the lines too.
We also noticed that the bubble on the University of Jamestown campus, where they have an artificial surface field underneath, they practice football in there, I'm sure. They probably do some soccer, maybe even some softball in there. That was also severely damaged on campus. So there are a lot of things around the state that that certainly will need some attention paid to, and hopefully everyone can recover nicely.
Absolutely.
Dave, you talked about a tornado you covered when you were a young reporter. Tell us more about the tornado that dates way back to 1978.
Well, here's what happened. My first job out of college was at KBOM, which is a station in Bismarck, Mandan. And, you know, I started June 1 as the news director, the entire news department, by the way. Here comes July 4th. And we had severe weather predicted, and a tornado hit Elgin, North Dakota. Well, my boss, in those days we didn't have cell phones, we had a pager, so I got paged, called him, and he said, you want to go to Elgin and do stories? And I said, sure. The program director came, picked me up, we drove to Elgin, and I'll never forget a couple of things. Number one, as we entered town, the only place that seemed to have electricity was the hospital. So we went to the hospital and did some interviews there, and people were willing to talk. They seemed a little shell-shocked because of the tornado that hit. And then we went downtown to a makeshift, like, staging area for people searching and rescue workers and things like that. It wasn't a building that was destroyed partially by a tornado, had no power, and they had to use flashlights. And then the other indelible image was leaving town and seeing the water tower in a just a tangled mess because of the tornado.
We hope that things like this don't happen again. But Dave, it sounds like, and you organize the weather for us here in the afternoons and evenings, we're going to need to be weather aware again, perhaps tomorrow.
That's exactly right. National Weather Service is saying there is a chance of scattered severe thunderstorms again. Basically, it's central and eastern North Dakota. The west seems to be okay, but central and eastern North Dakota into western Minnesota. Keep your eyes open, keep your ears on the forecast and on any watches or warnings or statements.
Dave, I'll be honest with you. When we moved here and I was considering the weather, it was all about winter. You know,
yes.
How are we going to make sure that we're going to be okay in winter and summer, and especially losing power in summer, honestly hadn't crossed my mind until now. And boy, our thoughts are with everyone who lost property, and especially our thoughts are with those who lost loved ones in last Friday's storm.
Absolutely, sure, for sure.
Dave, April oil numbers, let's turn the page a little bit. They're down slightly, and when the price of oil drops, it's great for us at the gas pump, Dave, but it's not so great for those who are out in the field trying to make oil and sell oil. Give us an update.
That's correct. It has ratcheted back, but of course it's being whipsawed by price, some of it, and demand seems to be, you know, maybe subject at least in part to the embargoes that are then in effect. And there's just some real concern among the big players in the Bakken that they may have to ratchet back production for a while until we get a better price. Now, the price is now predicted to be maybe as low as like $55 a barrel in part of the next 6 months to a year. But that could change. You know, it's a volatile market.
Dave, I remember from my work in Wyoming that producers, it seemed, wanted a price of $80 a barrel. Mm-hmm. That was a price where it then became profitable for them to do their work. Is that still kind of the benchmark?
Actually, they're talking about $70 to $75 a barrel makes it profitable. I know they'd like $80 because $80 will, you know, spur development in some of these non-Bakken areas. But you get 70 to 75, and then they'll start ratcheting up Bakken production a little bit more. But right now, you know, it's down around $68, $67, and there's a little cautiousness among the players in the oil industry.
Dave, you were at a meeting this morning, and now a decision is coming relative to some important pipelines.
Now, these pipelines would bring Bakken natural gas to central and eastern North Dakota. And there are two companies, WBAI Energy and Intensity Infrastructure Partners, who are proposing these trans-state pipelines to bring the natural gas to, especially, you know, Jamestown East, where there are proposed things like data centers and there are proposed things like industrial development, and they need natural gas. Well, here we've got a place where in Bakken wells, as the oil output goes down, natural gas output goes up, and they need to have a market to get that natural gas. So this is creating an in-state market. And along the way, although industrial customers are going to drive it, it will also help if you don't have natural gas to heat your home.
Dave, what are you and your staff working on?
Oh, just a number of things. We're going to be watching this because that's going to be probably next month. But I tell you, next week, we'll probably have better ideas about the potential for a special legislative session. They were talking about the governor's veto. That's one thing, but there's an attorney general's opinion saying you don't have to. However, a recent ruling by a federal court about the makeup of, you know, those districts that had sub-districts for Native Americans, they may have to do some redistricting. So there's going to be discussions on that.
Dave, I wonder too, would the legislature need to be called back in a special session to organize assistance and help from to support those who were impacted by Friday's storms?
Now, that's a possibility, but I honestly think that the governor and the Industrial Commission have the tools with the Bank of North Dakota to go ahead and do some things. And then what you do is if you need more money than that, then you can call them back, you know, for a short special session, and they can do something about that.
Well, Dave, right now I'm going to wish you a happy 4th of July.
Thank you.
Because you and I won't visit next week, but Main Street will be back likely on Tuesday, July 8th, and you and I will visit again then on July 10th.
Very good.
So between now and then, enjoy the holiday, and we'll look forward to seeing you when we get back in the saddle, so to speak, and our studio is put back together, Dave.
Thanks, Craig. Hope all goes well. Hope you're on time with that.
I think all of us do too, Dave. Best wishes.
Thank you.
Gather round, everybody. I'm gonna tell you a story about a little fella.
That's the fanfare that we hear each and every Thursday, kind of. We won't be with everyone next week, but we certainly are today, and we'll return 2 weeks from now. But Matt Olean joins us in the Main Street studio. Matt, welcome back to Main Street.
Thanks, Greg.
The movie this week is The Life of Chuck. Here's the trailer.
In this moment, I am wonderful.
When you look up at the night sky, it can tell you stuff about your future. It won't lie to you. It's pure that way. You might see a lot more than you wanted. But if you have heart, you have hope. And you have heart in you.
The world, Chuck. Everything you've ever loved. Everything you see. Every year that you live, that world will get bigger and brighter. And more detailed and complex. You fill the whole thing. It'll be a universe. Isn't that wonderful?
All right, Matt, this is a short story by Stephen King.
Hmm?
not exactly what we're used to from Stephen King. What do you think of the movie?
I think a lot of times we think of movie reviews as either good or bad, right? Sometimes sure. The answer is it's in the middle. And I think that is my answer today. That is an answer. It's there's good things about this movie and there's not as good things about this movie. Yes, it's a Stephen King novella, about a 60-page novella. This is his second collaboration with director Mike Flanagan. Now, Flanagan adapted Dr. Sleep, which was the sequel to The Shining. And I like that movie a lot, even though it underperformed at the box office. I want to say one thing right away for my listeners. I do know Mike Flanagan. He's a professional acquaintance. He's been to the Fargo Film Festival 3 times. So I just want to get that out of the way. I will do my best to be objective because, you know, I get along with Mike when he's here, and he's a talented guy who's achieved a lot. But just want to get that out of the way. I think there are really good things about this, and some things don't work. It's told in 3 acts backwards, okay? So it's a backwards story, kind of like Chris Nolan's Memento was back in 2001. So the film starts, it says Act 3, okay? And it works its way back as we find out about the life of Chuck, played by Tom Hiddleston, as a grown-up, and later played by Jacob Tremblay as a younger child. Tremblay, famous, Craig, as Brie Larson's son in the Oscar-winning film The Room, which Brie Larson got the Best Actress Oscar for. So it's kind of a dystopian view. Like in Act 3, Chiwetel Ejiofor from 12 Years a Slave fame and Karen Gillan are kind of the main actors in the first act, which is Act 3, if you're following me. Mm-hmm. And then later on, we will see Hiddleston arrive. I don't want to give too much plot points away because it is kind of a complicated plot to keep track of. And I think a lot of this does work pretty well. It's really nice visuals. I like the cinematography. But you're right. This is not a typical Stephen King story. It is heavy on the saccharine, heavy on the sentiment. And I think that's where I kind of land on kind of both sides of the fence, because I do think the film is really sentimental and saccharine. But I think a lot of people are going to like that part of it. And even the hardest of hearts people are going to be moved by some parts. I will say, without getting into too much plot, there are several dance sequences in the movie, including one with Tom Hiddleston and an actress, that kind of saved the movie. I mean, I was kind of not terribly engaged in the movie at the beginning, and then this dance sequence in Act 2 really kind of saves it, and it's a phenomenal dance sequence. It feels like you're watching a Gene Kelly movie. I also want to credit 2 other performances. Mia Sara and Mark Hamill play Chuck's grandparents in one of the acts, and they're really good in the movie. Ultimately, I think the point of the movie is it's about musings on life and how choices are sometimes made for us in life, and sometimes we make the choices ourselves, and sometimes we settle. We settle for what's called convention. It's also about the access to the inner world that people have, kind of this secret life that Chuck has in his brain that isn't typically, does not go with his job as an accountant in the movie. So I think some sequences work really well. The dance sequence is incredibly amazing. It is one of the best dance sequences. I felt like I was watching a 50s Gene Kelly movie. But other parts of it don't work. And here's the part, I think, where the literary origins of the life of Chuck give itself away. Nick Offerman, from Parks and Rec fame, great narrator, great voice, right? He's the narrator of this movie. And in some parts of the movie, he narrates and narrates and narrates and narrates. I love narration in movies like William Holden and Sunset Boulevard, but sometimes there can be too much. And I think there's too much narration in this movie to the point where I think that's why they have Offerman narrate, is to explain things that are literary on the page. And sometimes when you do that, Craig, the film becomes less cinematic. And there's so much exploratory explanation that Offerman does in the narration that I feel like he is reading from the novella. He's reading from the short story. And I think that does weaken the movie. It has bombed at the box office. $2 million opening weekend. This is a film that got the People's Choice Award at the Toronto Film Festival in 2024. And when it got that, there was Oscar talk, right? There was Oscar talk. This is going to be a big hit. And so far, it has not found an audience at the box office. And that is disappointing for Mike Flanagan, who, as I said, I do know. Whether it finds an audience, I don't know. Remember Shawshank Redemption, another Stephen King short story. It took a while for that movie to really find an audience, but it eventually did, and it became this monstrous hit on cable television, even though it was not a huge box office hit in theaters. So let's see if Life of Chuck finds that. It's not as good a film as Shawshank Redemption, but we'll see what happens. Some good performances. I think there's too much narration. It's a little too sweet and saccharine, but it does make you think about life. And as I said, the dance sequences are incredible, and Tom Hiddleston is really good as Chuck.
Anything coming down the pike from Stephen King that you're aware of?
I don't know. I don't know. He likes Mike Flanagan. They have a really good collaboration going with Dr. Sleep and this. And King has even urged people in a recent interview to go see this movie. He really wants people to see this movie. He likes how the movie turned out. And as I said, I don't know if it's going to find the big audience that can make it an Oscar contender. Reviews are all over the place on this one, Craig. Some are really, really positive. There are some really harsh negative reviews. As I said, I'm kind of in the middle. I do think people might enjoy it if they go, if you're ready to see a story told backwards.
Yeah, that's odd for me to grasp my head around, but yeah,
it works pretty well. It's just there's so much narration in it that it feels like you're watching a book on film a little bit.
All right, let's turn to the Oscar part of our weekly chit-chat, Matt. Kathy Bates won an Academy Award for Best Actress at the 63rd Academy Awards in 1991. For what movie, and was there a relationship to Stephen King?
Misery, and it is based on a novel by Stephen King.
We've been to the movies with Matt Olean.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 26th. The American Legion is the largest veterans organization in the nation and has been a part of North Dakota since 1919. Each year, members from across the state gather for their annual department convention, where the business of the organization is conducted and officers are elected for the new year. In 1935, Grand Forks hosted the event, and it was a grand affair. Running between June 23rd and 25th, the convention drew World War I veterans, who were the only ones eligible for membership at the time, and their wives, who made up the American Legion Auxiliary for a busy but fun time. The convention featured a parade, band concerts, and a smoker for Legion National Commander Frank Belgrano, who was the distinguished guest of the convention and delivered remarks. Highlights of the business discussed included creating a program to protect the state government from subversive elements, and charged posts and members with watching for such activities. In addition, the Legion pushed for the hiring of veterans first before non-servicemen for Civilian Conservation Corps camp work. Immediate payment of a promised bonus was also a priority, as this was the midst of the Great Depression and only a couple of years after the Bonus Army March on Washington. In addition, support for a recreation program for the State Planning Board and a new Sons of the Legion program was urged. Spencer Boyce of Bismarck was unanimously elected as the new department commander, succeeding Lynn Stambaugh, who later served as national commander of the organization in September of 1941. Other North Dakotans who served in that high office were former Governor John Davis, who served from 1966 to 1967, and H.F. Sparky Gehrke from 1988 to 1989. Today, the American Legion in North Dakota still meets annually for their department convention, and their ranks have grown to include all veterans that have served since December 7th, 1941. They have an active Sons of the American Legion program for male descendants of Legion members, and the American Legion Auxiliary continues its work in support of the Legion. Going strong for over 100 years, the Legion family continues to fight for veterans and their families, ensuring they receive the benefits earned through their service, while still having fun and building friendships. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Daniel Sauerwein. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Music.
And that's a wrap for this Thursday edition of Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. A little bit of news for our listeners. Main Street now will be off until July 8th. We're undergoing some much needed renovation in our Main Street studio, and it kind of puts us out of commission for just a little bit. But in between now and then, we hope you enjoy summer, enjoy the 4th of July, and we will look forward to seeing you again right back here on Tuesday, July 8th on Main Street.